Hello, welcome to Razor's Edge, local and independent current affairs straight from Sydney on 2SER 107.3. I'm Daniel Butler. Today on the show...
But it's more about making sure that if we don't get the change that we want or we don't get what we expect, to not necessarily let them ruin our lives. And I think that's the important thing.
With the excitement of the climate strike gone and the realities of climate change becoming ever more apparent, eco-anxiety is becoming a recognised phenomenon, especially amongst younger people. What are the strategies to cope? Also on the show today...
But the law as it's proposed at the moment would see somebody who was going to have a sit-in or something like that face up to 3 years in jail because they've got this protest.
A new bill designed to discourage animal rights activists from protesting on farms places jail time on offenders. But critics of the law say it goes even further and could discourage activism altogether. All that and more coming up on Razor's Edge. But first... During budget estimate meetings earlier this week, the New South Wales Police Commissioner disclosed that police are required to meet quotas and KPI targets for personal and strip searches. The revelation follows the release of the Rethinking Strip Searches report, commissioned by the Redfern Legal Centre, which found strip searches in New South Wales had dramatically increased and that police are often conducting unlawful searches. This has highlighted the culture within New South Wales Police and placed further tension on the relationship between police and the public. Kate Atkinson has this report.
Targets have a negative impact on policing. It becomes an emphasis on a numbers game rather than trying to adhere to law enforcement and the rule of law. It also puts undue pressure on police, and then what happens is that police cut corners and the emphasis is on trying to get those numbers up in any possible means can have unintended consequences, and those consequences are no doubt negative.
Samantha Lee says that the presence of quotas can explain why there has been such an increase of strip searches in recent years.
It does indicate that there is pressure on police to conduct as many strip searches as possible, and that's certainly what we're seeing on the ground in terms of clients coming to Redfern Legal. What we're seeing is that police are conducting strip searches without adhering to the legislation and its requirements.
However, the police also need to consider the attitudes and guidelines within their institution.
But also I think it indicates that there is a culture within the police force that needs to be dealt with, and that can only be dealt at a ministerial and commissioner level.
However, Michael Grucock, a lecturer of law at UNSW and one of the co-authors of the Rethinking Strip Searches report, says that quotas are just one of many factors contributing to the rise of strip searches.
Well, I don't think it's the biggest explanation. I think it's symptomatic of a general approach towards strip searches. And there's two main concerns that we identified in the report. The first, as we've already said, is that there's simply not a systematic application of the law, and that goes to a sort of question of understanding and also internal police culture. But the second thing is clearly the increased use of sniffer dogs and the rollout of dogs more widely across the whole transport network.
In many cases, the demand to reach targets can lead to over-policing and unlawful practices by police officers.
It certainly leads not just to over-policing, but policing that is cutting corners and policing where the rule of law and legislation is not adhered to.
But the more serious issue is the impact it has on the relationship between the police and the community.
What we want to see is that anyone feels that they can ask a police officer for help, no matter what situation they're in. But this type of policing is creating a divide and causing harm because people don't feel like that the police is a service there for them. If the public believe that police are exerting their power for a reason that is not law enforcement, but is to meet target and quotas, then the whole trust in the system starts to deteriorate.
However, Dr. Michael Grewcock says that the interest in this issue has risen because it's hit a nerve with the general public.
Most people don't expect this sort of behaviour from the police. Most people don't want to go, you know, people commuting at Central Station, for example, don't want to be walking past strip search dogs at 3 o'clock in the afternoon with booths set up in the walkway near Andy Avenue. You know, people going to music festivals don't want to have to confront dogs before they go. And what this is happening is there's a significant portion of the population has now been exposed to the widespread use of dogs, and there's a resistance to it. And I think that's the real issue. But a bigger question is, and one which is not sort of ventilated nearly as much, is that for many years there have been concerns about the excessive use of strip searches on Indigenous communities. That's tended to sort of slip beneath the radar a bit because the focus has been on music festivals.
Dr. Michael Grewcock says that the problem with quotas is that they are designed to be a measure of police effectiveness and are an assumption of unlawful activity in society.
The basic premise behind quotas is that you can assume that there is a certain amount of activity going out there which can legitimately be policed. What we say is we need to take one step back and look in terms of what the law actually enables the police to do. And in relation to searches, first of all, they've got to be able to have reasonable suspicion. And secondly, in relation to strip searches, as I said earlier, there needs to be urgent and necessary for the purposes of the search. And if you have quotas, that basically distracts the police from what they're supposed to be focusing on when they make the decision to conduct a strip search. So on that basis, we're opposed to them being used in that way.
The Law Enforcement Conduct Commission has been investigating the use of strip searches by police in New South Wales, but Samantha Lee says they need to also consider the impact of quotas.
There is no doubt that targets would have some form of impact on the numbers of strip searches in New South Wales, and the LEC is the best body to investigate that.
The LEC can recommend criminal proceedings, disciplinary action or policy changes, but according to Samantha Lee, it's the law that needs to be addressed.
We do still think that the law in terms of strip searches in New South Wales fails to provide police with clear, rigorous guidance about how and when to conduct a strip search, and fails to provide some very needed safeguards for members of the public. So at the very least, we would like to see is for the law in New South Wales to be changed.
Samantha Lee, Head of Police Accountability and Government Law at the Redfern Legal Centre, ending that report by Kate Atkinson.
Casula Powerhouse is celebrating 25 years of cutting-edge arts, culture and entertainment. Be a part of the action and head out to Liverpool to celebrate on Saturday, October 26th. It'll be a day and night of surprises, featuring 4 new commission performances, an exhibition launch, live music and refreshments. It's family friendly and free. Cheers to 25 years. Casula Powerhouse sponsors 2SER.
I'm Daniel Butler and you are listening to Razor's Edge on 2SER 107.3. Well, the Nationals have called for an overhaul of the New South Wales Independent Planning Commission after the body rejected a coal mine in Bylong. The mine was rejected overwhelmingly because of environmental concerns, including degradation to the groundwater and lasting damage to the surrounding landscape. Despite overwhelming local support for the IPC's rejection, the Nationals want to overhaul the body to give foreign investors more certainty. Talia Kreft has this report.
KEPCO's $700 million Bylong coal project has been rejected by the Independent Planning Commission on the grounds of environmental, agricultural and heritage concern. One of the environmental impacts cited was the contamination of underlying groundwater the mine would cause. The South Korean company behind the Bylong mine has claimed that it would provide hundreds of jobs for the region. But the IPC found that the project posed too great a risk to the region. Nationals Minister for the Upper Hunter, Michael Johnson, says mining companies should not be held responsible for the emissions of coal overseas.
And one of the key reasons, they said, was because of the intergenerational lack of equity. Now, how they could quantify that is beyond me. They haven't been able to answer that question in terms of how they quantify what does intergenerational equity mean in this particular case. But of course, one of the other things, which is the key, one of the key aspects of it, is that there is such a thing as scope 3 emissions. So which basically means that anything that comes out of Australia is we are responsible for emissions in other countries. And I'm going to put another angle on this. We do a lot of wine exports, for example. So let's say we exported wine to a particular country, someone bought a bottle of wine, got too drunk, had an accident, hurt themselves, whatever the case may be. And are we then responsible as a country for someone drinking too much and having an accident and hurting themselves? Because it's the same concept with this particular mine or any other mine.
Michael Johnson argues we need to make changes to how the IPC approves mines.
And so we are looking at changes to the legislation to make it clearer for assessments around that particular aspect. And, you know, if we don't do something like that, then Australia, indeed New South Wales, will be a place that is considered by international investors as a place of high sovereign risk, which means that we won't get international investment. And we know from anecdotal evidence that that's already happening. We are getting corporations and governments around the world saying New South Wales is too risky to invest in. There's no certainty around the planning process. We don't know. We can waste hundreds of millions of dollars, as KEPCO has, and still not get a result despite being led on all the way. And that's an unacceptable situation.
Professor Jeremy Moss from the University of New South Wales thinks the decision to reject the mine is indicative of Australia moving away from coal.
So Australia has certainly well and truly begun that transition. So as I understand it, in 2018, about 20 or 21% of Australia's energy came from renewable sources, mostly hydro and mostly wind. But that's a much higher percentage than existed even 5 years ago. And the amount of new energy generation from renewable sources that is being built or scheduled to be built is very high. So we are making the transition at a faster and faster rate. But unfortunately, it still remains the case that around 80% of our power is generated from non-renewable sources. And that is still a problem, given that we're one of the highest per capita emitters of greenhouse gases in the world. So we really need to speed up our transition.
He thinks the Nationals' call to overhaul the Independent Planning Commission is not in line with what the community is calling for.
Well, look, I think the Nationals are really a long way out of date in calling for that to happen. The planning committee recommending against the Bylong coal mine was in fact a very positive decision. And I think the sooner the Nationals start recognising that coal is the fuel of the past, not the future.
I'm Daniel Butler and you are listening to Razor's Edge, coming to you live from this place known as Sydney, on Gadigal land of the Eora Nation, of which sovereignty was never ceded. Well, a new study released by mental health organisation Reach Out has detailed that 77% of young people feel that their concerns about the environment aren't being taken seriously by the Australian government. Psychologists fear that these concerns are turning into serious mental health conditions, including the newly coined eco-anxiety. Eva Blakemore spoke to child and educational psychologist Andrew Greenfield to find out what that means for the next generation.
So there's been a lot of discussion recently around children and young adults feeling eco-anxiety. Can you explain what exactly this phenomenon is?
Yeah, I guess it's the anxiety that they feel related to. Well, I guess there's probably two aspects to it. One is the fact that they feel as if politicians and people in power are ignoring what's happening in the world in terms of the climate change debate, but also, I guess, to some degree, some feel of helplessness from their own perspective as to what they can or can't do in terms of that, and that creates its own anxieties. So I think it's probably a combination of those two aspects.
What do you think the major contributors are to this anxiety then? I mean, is social media playing a role, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, you certainly got, you know, Greta Thunberg and her address, and that's all, you know, raising the awareness of it all. But it's a combination of the fact that they feel as if nobody's, the people in power aren't listening. And I think that's part of the anxiety.
So rather than calling for political change, what do you think children should be doing that's more realistic or that will contribute less to their anxiety?
Well, it's about doing whatever you think your you're either comfortable doing. You know, to me, I often talk to kids about living with uncomfortability, and that's important because we're going to be uncomfortable for so many reasons, because we're anxious or we're stressed or we're upset or we're passionate. Nothing wrong with that. We have to learn to live with that and to be able to learn to carry on with our lives the best we can, at the same time making sure that our opinion is heard.
So it's more about learning to deal with the anxieties rather than expecting them to go away.
Yeah. You know, I think it's about making sure that they understand what the concepts are. But even if you know, your power as an individual, a student, and by protesting, may not necessarily get the politicians or the people in power to actually make a change. I mean, that's a huge thing to ask for.
And have we ever seen such a collective kind of anxiety about the one thing in young people?
There are always things that pop up. I mean, I can't think of anything offhand that is. But I think there are always things that gain momentum, people run with, gets media coverage, and then it kind of goes away to some degree. But it is. It's something that always happens, and I don't think it'll ever go away. But, you know, we have to be able to put things into perspective. That's the main thing. You know, it's about trying to focus on what individuals can do day to day and making sure that they don't let the lack of control there ruin other aspects of their lives or carry over into some sort of massive anxiety that extends to other areas or even depressions.
And do you see this sort of eco-anxiety coming to an end anytime soon, or is this going to be a lengthy sort of phenomenon that affects kids for years to come?
Yeah, I mean, it is. It is going to be something that is an ongoing debate, whether we like it or not. It's not something that's going to change overnight. It might take 20, 20, 30 years for us to even have any meaningful impact on what's happening. I don't know. So I don't see it as something that's going to be going away anytime soon. And I guess this generation that are discussing and protesting and debating are the generation that is going to grow up to hopefully see some sort of change.
And so as a psychologist, what would you say to kids that are feeling this sort of anxiety or this sense of dread? What are their options and what should they be doing to sort of curb that?
Communicating with people, such as psychologists or course counsellors or parents or anyone really that they trust, and focusing on what we can control, not necessarily on what we can't. Does it mean that we've got to stop using our voice? Absolutely not. Because I think it's important for anyone to be able to use their voice in anything and that they feel passionate about. So that I would never say, oh, just leave it alone, you're never going to make a change. Absolutely not. But it's more about making sure that if we don't get the change that we want or we don't get what we expect, to not necessarily let that ruin our lives. And I think that's the important thing. It's about changing what your expectations are.
Right. So managing expectations is...
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I said, you know, because a lot of the kids that I see, they're only going to stop being anxious. They're only going to feel this comfortability once they get what they want. Well, that's almost impossible. To be able to get what you want is to make politicians make changes. Well, that's very difficult to do, whether we like it or not, because we're not the politicians. We're not the one in power. But, you know, but at the same time, it depends on what changes you can, having said that, you said you can make your own changes, you can make your own small changes, and that's something that you do have control and power over.
Do you think any of the responsibility lies with the way we talk about climate change or the way parents are talking about climate change with their kids?
I think we've got to take some responsibility as parents to be able to say, okay, well, to discuss and talk to our kids about it, regardless of their view, and to make sure that we're the ones who are responsible for their mental health, and to make sure that congratulate them for being able to be concerned about what's happening, but not necessarily let that lead us into a state of anxiety or depression.
Psychologist Andrew Greenfield finishing that report by Eva Blakemore.
This October, 2CR is celebrating 40 years of supporter-funded radio. As part of the festivities, join us on Friday, October 4 for a very special edition of The Band's Next Door live from the loft at UTS. Expect to be charmed and heartbroken by folk maiden Lisa Caruso. Thrilled by the rock and roll sounds of cult outfit The Holy Soul, and get that warm embrace of classic indie styles thanks to Bland. Doors from 7, music from 8, and free entry all night. 2CR, 40 years of stories, ideas, and live music.
Yes, you are listening to Razor's Edge on 2CR 107.3. Animal activists are on the government's agenda after Agricultural Minister Adam Marshall introduced a bill called Right to Farm, which heavily penalises animal activists who trespass on private property. The National Farmers Federation has endorsed the bill, saying that not enough has been done to stop coordinated anti-farming activism. But there are fears the bill has wording that could penalise all types of activism. Luis Ribera asked Chris Gambian, Chief Executive Officer of the Nature Conservation Council of New South Wales, what his thoughts were on the new bill.
The proposed bill in front of the Parliament just at the moment that is called the Right to Farm Bill, which is a bit of a mischievous name, is really an attack on the right that every citizen has in New South Wales to protest, to express a differing point of view, and by taking action on that point of view. We are lucky to live in a free country, in a democracy, where you don't have to agree with everything that the government does or everything that a corporation, for example, might do, and that you're free to express that through protest. It's one of the values that we hold very dear. But the problem with this bill is that it makes the penalties for trespass so severe and so strict that it really infringes upon that right to protest. It's always been against the law to trespass, and if you're a protester, you take some risks in deciding to do that if you're passionate about a cause. But the law, as it's proposed at the moment, would see somebody who was going to, say, have a sit-in or something like that, face up to 3 years in jail because they've got this protest, and we think that that is very much excessive.
So can you tell us what is the main driver for this bill to go through?
Well, I wouldn't want to speculate on what has brought it about, but what I do know is that whilst it's called the Right to Farm Bill, it's got nothing to do with farming. It's got everything to do with our democratic right to protest. And actually, farmers have been at the forefront of some of the most important struggles in the environment movement over the last few decades. So if you look at things like the Bentley blockade, which was to try to stop CSG, coal seam gas that is, mining on farmland, on some of our best agricultural land, that was really led by farmers. So this idea that it somehow improves the rights of farmers is very Orwellian language. It doesn't do that at all.
Oh, okay. So this bill is not only applicable to animal activists.
Well, no. The bill is about protesting on what's called enclosed land. And that is really any land that has a fence around it. And the particular provisions that we're concerned about are the ones that relate to property where business is being conducted. So that might be a shop, for example, a shopping centre, the workers, you know, cleaners who are protesting for better pay and conditions. It might be a bank where a pensioner who's being ripped off by the bank. It's just some very clever language. There seems to be a bit of a turf battle going on between the National Party and the Shooters, Farmers and Fishers Party. They want to, you know, demonstrate who's the toughest or who's hairy-chested. In fact, it's not about farming. It's actually about anyone who's trying to protest on what's called enclosed land. And enclosed land is defined as anything that has got a fence around it.
Do you think farmers are aware of this?
I wouldn't want to speculate, but I know that farmers who care deeply about their land and deeply about their community, and I know there are lots of farmers in that boat, would be very nervous about the implications of this bill because it goes much further than anything that the minister or anybody else has said it would.
Do you think activists should be more conservative while protesting on the streets?
Well, I think the thing is that in a democracy, we don't need to agree with everything the protester has to say to agree that they've got a right to say it. And so I would say if somebody wants to protest about animal rights or about saving a forest or about anti-coal seam gas mining or a workplace right or any number of other things, they should be able to do that. There is law in place already that protects property holders from unreasonable behaviour. There's all sorts of laws that already exist that that protect against improper behaviour, protests that are violent, for example, or protests that might get out of hand. But just because somebody might disagree from time to time with what a protester has to say, one of the central tenets of our democracy is to say that everybody's got a right to put their view peacefully. And I think that's the most important issue at stake in this particular legislation.
Okay, so in a nutshell, you believe that all types of protests are okay as long as they are conducted peacefully?
That's right. That's my view. I think peaceful protest is really important. I think that anyone who seeks to make change should engage in peaceful protest. But I think no matter whether or not you agree with the particular protester, and sometimes you will and sometimes you won't, you've got to be prepared to accept that our democracy is made stronger by hearing all voices.
Chris Gambian, Chief Executive Officer of the Nature Conservation Council of New South Wales, ending that report by Luis Ribera. Well, that's all we have time for tonight. Thanks for listening to Razor's Edge on 2SER 107.3. Razor's Edge is produced on Gadigal land of the Eora Nation. Catch us again next week on Thursday night at 7:30 p.m. I'm Daniel Butler. Till next time.
Nighttime, when I hear your song again.